Our focus today is on user experience, or UX. It's a name that's been around for a while, but it still seems to raise a lot of questions. Who or what is a user? What experience are we talking about? Is it something to do with design? Is it to do with service? Is it the same as service design? How does it connect with behavioral economics or behavioral science? So Simon Norris, my guest today, can confidently be called a bit of an expert in this area. He's the founder and the CEO of Nomensa, which is one of the UK's largest dedicated UX companies. He's been absolutely a pioneer of the development of UX and has seen this industry go through many changes over the past 25 years. Simon, welcome to the 10th Degree. Really pleased to have you here because we've met a few times over the years and I've always been fascinated talking with you and I always appreciate the insights that you bring into any conversation. So I'm really excited, I think, about our conversation today just because I get a chance to ask you lots of questions, dive into this and hopefully we can share this with people much more broadly.
Thank you for that. I'm excited to answer your question as well. And it's always nice to be in the company of people that you like.
Oh, well, okay, I'll take that as a plus one. So why don't we start with user experience? Can you define that, what you mean by user experience?
I mean, this is a tricky question. I say that because on one level, it's easy to answer, but on another level, it's quite difficult to answer. Simply put, it's a person's overall experience using a product or service and how that product or service may look. Often referred to look and feel from a design perspective. So how something looks and how it feels. So to a certain extent, that means that experience tends to be about functionality and visual. Whereas if you think about what does user experience mean, which actually is quite a deep question, you have to start to think about what is the nature of experience? How do we experience? So from one perspective, if you imagine we're having this conversation right now, you've done a really lovely introduction, I'm responding to questions that you're asking, that's our experiencing happening. It's our constant flow of thoughts and feelings that are happening right now. Whereas what you'll remember is experience. In saying that, there's this idea that experience is about memory, specifically episodical, autobiographical memory, the things that we remember. To put it really, really clearly, if you went and listened to an orchestra play, you're right there, you're listening to the music, it's amazing. You're experiencing all those moments together in real time. You go back and you talk about it with your wife or whoever you're there with, and you kind of recollect certain elements of the performance. That's experience. You're using your memory to recall aspects, episodes of that experience. So there's this really key relationship between experience and experiencing. So whilst on one level, experience is about how products or services may look and feel, at another level, especially in a world that's becoming increasingly more digitized, experience needs to be thought of in a much broader way than just the products and services that we use.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It actually reminds me going back into my past life when I worked in theatre. So it struck me that in theatre, you go along and you have these amazing experiences, and a lot of that is based on an emotion. But what you hear, what you experience are words. And you take someone like Oscar Wilde, Salome. Salome was written in French. It's translated, it's a great play in English. But you think that is the same experience, whether you get it in French or whether you get it in English. It's just the way that you decode the experience is the use of the words. So the words are not the important thing. It's the intention behind the words. It's the emotion behind the words. And that's what really sticks with you. And that's the thing that really strikes you as somebody who's sitting in the audience. So you use the metaphor of orchestra and music. And it's very similar, but I think it's just interesting that we get caught up on what things say, but actually it's about how you say that, how you receive that, which seems to be more important.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good point that you're making. I mean, there's a big movement in cognition around an area called embodied cognition. So what we now know is that our interactions with our environment deeply affect us both cognitively and emotionally. And I think, you know, that's as true as it is for user experience in terms of, say, products and services, as it is for theatre experience, as it would be for an orchestral experience. you know, we take things with us when we have those experiences as well. I mean, we were discussing that prior to the questions that you were asking, you know, the way actual things that make up our life, that bring us to this moment right now, those are deeply embodied within who we are and what we are and how we feel and how we respond and how we think. So kind of user experience to a certain extent is very much about understanding sort of human behavior, human cognitive behavior, human emotional behavior, as well as then trying to take all that understanding and turn it into something useful. And that kind of process of useful is what we call design.
So what you're trying to do is essentially take those components of who we are and how we feel, but you're sitting there in a context where you're trying to connect somebody who has a product or a service that they want to offer and trying to find a way in which that can connect in a meaningful way with the person who you want to buy or to listen or to take part in, share in whatever it is that you're trying to offer with them. Is your focus mainly around digital, or do you look more broadly than that?
In the beginning, it was digital, and I was quite specific about that. And when I say in the beginning, probably in the first 5 to 10 years, there were a couple of projects and engagements that we had where we would have to think more broadly. And we were asked whether we would consider things that were physical products rather than digital products. And we tended to kind of just focus on the digital side. The reason for that was that we were more familiar with digital. We thought we could be more authentic about digital. Our backgrounds and research backgrounds were in digital rather than, say, products. Today is very different. We've seen a massive shift in the world. We go back to the inception of the iPhone back in 2007, and we see a real global inflection point that kind of changed a great many things about how we use technology. Where technology sits with us as human beings, you know, no longer being something that we merely do at work or at home, but something that is with us all the time. I mean, with a smartphone or a smart device, you pretty much can do computing wherever you want, whenever you want, just before you go to bed, on the bus as you're traveling to work, sat on the train. It pretty much is often the first thing you look at in the morning, the last thing you look at night. Whether that's good or bad is a bigger debate than the time that we've got. My point is that the kind of inception of one technology has really ushered in a much more and deeper perspective with technology for all of us.
It's been really interesting, that kind of idea of the phone. I remember probably must have been about 5 years ago, there was a shift from design and thinking from your product of how do you connect with people on a computer, but then the phone changed that and became not something that was external to an individual, but part of the individual. So when you talk about your phone, you're actually talking about me because you're holding on to that. It's a part of you. You carry it everywhere. You look at people as they leave the table, they pick their phone up and take it with them. It's almost like a Damon in the Philip Pullman novel, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's like, this is my part. This is kind of, this houses part of my soul because this is who I'm communicating with. So when you're thinking about how do you start communicating with people about your products and your services, actually you're not communicating to their technology, you're connecting with them. And the phone is just the device through which you do that. It seemed like there was a bit of a shift. Is that true?
I think so. I think the smart devices that we use today allow a much broader embrace of our behaviors. When, you know, we're not just using them to send text or to make phone calls. We're using them for all manners of things. I mean, even the advertising that we see behind some of the phone manufacturers demonstrate that, how we can use these technologies, not just to communicate, but to learn, to share, to feel connected in interesting and novel ways, ways that were once considered to be purely social. These smart devices are sort of breaking down the barriers between what we can and cannot do, how we can and cannot interact, or how we should consider that. So it's interesting. I think one of the bigger dangers, as we know, is issue around privacy and surveillance. People are becoming more savvy to the value of their information, the value of their data. They're becoming more savvy, and rightly so, to not just treating their phone, as you suggested, as a or the key piece of technology. They're kind of realizing that what they do with their phone and that data is also very important and very personal. So the idea of, say, surveillance capitalism, where someone may be able to say, well, we're not collecting your personal information. People are now savvy to the nonsense of that. Well, it's not your personal information. It's the aggregation of that information and how they can do trend analysis, and then they can start to suggest and make influence. So we need to live in a world that kind of better understands that the connections that we make and the digital trails that we leave from those connections needs to be understood and valued without abuse.
Okay. I love all this stuff. And there's a danger that I could take us down a very deep, abstract, existential rabbit hole down here. So let's just come back for a second. And to get to that point first, so when you start talking with people in the first instance, where do you start? When somebody comes in and says, Simon, I need you to UX me. What are you looking at? What is it that somebody who's got this idea that they want to share and, you know, commercialize usually, what's your starting point?
That's a good question. So the first thing we need to understand is how to frame their ask from an experiential perspective. What that means is, what are they trying to achieve from a consumer perspective? What is the value that they wish to offer? Is it that they're not communicating the value of their products or their services as well as they could be? Is it that they feel that they are not as modern as their competitors and they've fallen behind and they need to catch up? Is it that it's a new product or a new service and they want to make sure that they communicate it in the right way? Is it actually understanding what their customers want, need, and expect? So the first thing is about really trying to understand, actually, what is it that they're trying to achieve? What are the business problems that they're tackling as an organization, so that we can make sure that we match whatever we do to best help them support that? So sometimes they may just ask to get a better sense of how to do consumer and user research around their product and services, not really having done much of that before. So don't treat them naively, because, you know, this field that we're in is still pretty nascent in comparison to, say, other mature fields. So what we would then do in that case is we would try to understand and work with them, firstly, to work out what they know, because they know a lot. They really do know a lot about how people buy, how they market, how they're different, how their market works, how their operation works. You know, we need to understand those factors to be able to match what we do, so that we can help them design the right type of customer experience that they need.
Okay. So that's a really interesting point, that point about talking to them, about essentially researching them. So do you think people undervalue the knowledge that they already have themselves? Do they feel like, well, this is an area that I'm not necessarily too familiar in, I need to go off and get some external help, but actually there's a lot of stuff that they can just generate themselves by just trying to think a bit more concretely about what they know, a bit more methodically maybe?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think they can think more methodically about what they know. If they do that, what they're able to then work out is where there are gaps. And those gaps are opportunities for understanding. Where there are opportunities for understanding mean that there are opportunities for insight. And kind of what we're always saying to our clients, and especially new clients, is that it only takes one insight to be significant in being a game changer. It doesn't take loads. I'm not saying that they don't expect loads or they want lots of recommendations and lots of design support, but you know, we explain to them that if you understand how your audience, your consumers, use your products, then you've taken this critical step in trying to understand the value that they expect, want. If you understand the value that they expect or want, oftenly referred to as a value proposition, this is brilliant, because a value proposition is the very foundation on which you actually design and scale your experience.
Do you use things like the value proposition canvas to get to the bottom of that? It's kind of like, are there tools that you can just employ?
Yes. So what we tend to do is we tend to take a tool and use it where it's relevant, modify it for our uses, and that's one that we've actually modified. So often these tools are very general purpose, so they need to be adapted for experience design work, specifically thinking in an experience design way.
Do you think there's anything kind of particular that may be missing that you would add in, that you think, well, this is really a critical part of that thinking process, that if you're trying to, essentially it comes down to understanding the customer, isn't it? So there's something around customer profiling in order to be able to connect with people in a way that they want to be connected with, not the way that you think you ought to be connecting with them, because it's all about them, not about you. So are there things that you feel people maybe should be focusing on more in order to try and get to the bottom of that question?
Yeah, so I mean, let's be specific. The canvas doesn't really address how you move from thinking around, say, business models and revenue models and markets and market behavior and then translating that into design. That's the bit that's missing. Yeah. So without that bit, you've only got one half of a side of a coin. You need the other half. You need to understand how something is and why it is what it is. And then you need to translate that. So translation is a skill into design. Okay. So let's play this out in terms of Uber. If I asked you, what is Uber? Now, like most people, you'll probably be thinking this. It's an app or it's a platform, right?
I would be thinking it is a, software.
Okay, so software.
Yeah.
Now, we know the web allows us to provide software digitally in a distributed way. So if you're a startup and you use the word platforms, that's the sort of thing that kind of people that are investing into it like. If you say, you know, you add another phrase like machine learning into that, they're going to definitely like that a lot. So, you know, these are the kind of things that they're looking for you to say. Now, I would argue that's great. That's great that you have this perspective, but we're talking about technology. So there's this idea that technology will make a difference. That is what I call a technology dominant perspective. I don't think it's necessarily right. I think there's a massive, massive missing element. So technology by itself will not lead to superior customer experience. That would be like saying to an executive, buy these Honman golf clubs at $80,000. They're gold-plated, by the way. They will improve your golfing. They're going to look at you in a very odd way. How can buying a technology like golf clubs or any technology lead to a better outcome? It's kind of missing the whole point around human behavior and therefore designing human behavior. So the way I explain it to clients is technology is necessary. You cannot separate technology and experience. They go hand in hand. But when you start to realize that technology is the medium of experience, you start to realize that that medium needs to be designed. It's not enough just to think in terms of function, as we said in the beginning, or to think in terms of aesthetics. You have to think in terms of value proposition. So going back to Uber to answer the question, yes, Uber is technology, software. It is definitely that. But more than that, it is technology and software that allows people to gain a level of convenience that is unprecedented in comparison to anything that has ever come before, ever, in the sense that they've taken the simple activity of taking and requesting a taxi and they've digitized it in a way, adding a layer of convenience that has transformed that whole sector. So this is kind of the difference between what digital technology, what it can do. But first, you have to be able to understand, well, what is the proposition that it's going to deliver?
Yeah, well, I think you could imagine the Uber investment pitch, couldn't you? You could see them standing up in front of people and say, right, just imagine you are on a street corner calling up your taxi company for the third time saying, where's my taxi? And then they say, oh, it was there 5 minutes ago. And you know it wasn't there 5 minutes ago because you were standing there 5 minutes ago. So just from that point, you would have everybody going, yeah, we all, well, I mean, if you're young, you probably don't because you've got Uber. But beforehand, that's what used to happen. It's smoke, mirrors and lies. So getting past that would be the experience. So describing, okay, you can actually see where the taxi is. You can book it online. So it's about convenience. It's about ease. So that really, I suppose, is the value that you get from Uber because it just overhauls what was just accepted, but nobody realized that they could do anything about it until Uber came along and changed the game. So trying to understand that value, that's, like you say, it's critical. You've also talked about the double diamond process. So I'm thinking about what do you do to get the insights that you're talking about and convert them into something practical and usable. So, but you also adapted the double diamond process to make it a double diamond or a triple diamond or a sort of, there's extra diamonds in there somewhere. So is that part of the sort of thing that you would do in terms of thinking of, okay, if we create this technology, there is a very, very strong chance that nobody will buy it because we don't understand why people want to use it. We think there's a myriad number of examples of technology in search of a problem. So see them all the time, and they're people putting bids in for things with that, as opposed to being, here is a problem, and this is the solution I'm trying to get. So if you're trying to get to understand what the problem is that you're trying to fix, what sort of tools do you use to really get into that?
That's a good question. So we will take a current tool set, a current methodology, and we'll start to think about how relevant that tool set is. And, you know, through use and practice, you start to see limitations. Or what actually happens is that you start to address or get asked different sorts of questions. And you have then an opportunity to think, well, do we throw everything out? Or do we think about actually what bits are good and what bits we may need to extend? Now, I have on my office upstairs in Queen's Square, I have a quote on the wall from Sir Henry Royce, who was the other half of the Rolls-Royce brand. And it goes like this: strive for perfection in everything you do. Take the best that exists and make it better. When it doesn't exist, design it. And that, in a nutshell, is kind of how I think, and is probably one of the kind of underlying unsaid perspectives about Numensa. You have to look at what exists, which applies with a client. What do they know? You have to think about how they are currently delivering their experience, how the value proposition works within that experience. And then you have to think, okay, what bits do we need to keep? What bits do we need to change? And what bits will we need to design from scratch, from new? And that from scratch, from new doesn't mean that they're wrong. It means that you've identified things that will enhance actually what they want to become. So it's not a sort of a criticism of their lack of appreciation. It's more a case of helping them on what I call a capability trajectory, from recognizing how capable they are currently and understanding of how capable they want to become. To put it another way, you have to show them how to improve so they can improve.
And in order to achieve that, do you do a lot of market research? Do you find that works for you? And you know, do you do qualitative research, quantitative research? Is it speaking directly to people? Is it doing research that people don't know that they're actually being researched at the time? What's the most effective way of trying to understand what that value is that you can offer?
We do lots of different sorts of research. So there's a lot of research that you can look at that's currently available online, which is traditionally called secondary research. Primary research is when you start to address issues with methodologies, surveying people, like interviewing people, like showing people things and seeing how they respond, how they interact with things. Often goes by the name of user testing or usability testing. But you can also kind of test how people think about propositions. You can test how they think about experience, because we know that experience is autobiographical. So if we take, for example, a wedding, we know that there are certain aspects of the wedding. So there's a schema, a structure to a wedding. You know, whether that wedding is in a tent, in a field, in Italy, in a castle, wherever it may be, the place where the wedding takes place is not as important as understanding the bits of the wedding that will happen. You know, there's a coming together of people. There's probably an exchange from one family to another. There's the meeting of larger families coming together. And then there's all the associated events that lead up to that moment where two people come together. And then all the things that happen after. And we can kind of think of these as sort of patterns of experience, patterns of commonality that we know that we can design for. Now, you can't design for everything. You can't know everything, but you can know enough to start to frame together actually and choreograph the type of experience that you need to design. And what research does is it helps you identify the gaps where you may not have knowledge, or you seek a greater sense of understanding or insight to kind of move from, say, a 20% understanding of how people use your products or services to a 50, a 60, a 70, a 80% understanding of how people use your products or services. It will involve looking at a lot of data, and it will involve trying to think about everything as a whole rather than trying just to think about the individual elements. So You know, when you're thinking from a research perspective, you've got to have what I call a kind of a gestalt perspective. You've got to really think about it in a kind of a systematic, holistic way to really get a sense of what we're trying to do here. You know, an organization exists within a market or a sector. There are employees, there are customers, consumers. You know, there are lots of interactions that are happening at different levels. It's not just a simple case of the product and the market. It's much broader and deeper than that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that kind of near the beginning of that Yuval Noah Harari book, Sapiens, in terms of describing what a company is, kind of he takes this idea in terms of using the idea of a company to try and, I suppose, describe humans' ability for abstract conceptual thinking. And it's a really nice way of putting it in terms of trying to get a picture of what that holistic image is, and in a very short and really nicely written thing. So if you haven't read it, that's well worth looking into. But does that mean, from what you're saying, that in a way this experience design is an iterative process? Because you can never know everything. And so if you can get to be 60, 70, 80% right, that's still another 30, 20, 10% that you still need to try and discover. So are you always only in beta? Are you kind of like, here we get to phase one, but we need to see how people respond. Let's put it out there. Let's see what the response is, and let's go back and adjust and do that. But people's behavior will keep changing because the world keeps changing. So it's never a still process. Are you always trying to find that holy grail almost in terms of striving for perfection, but not quite achieving it?
Yeah, that's a really good question in itself. And we could just spend hours just talking about that. I think the word iterative is something that is often associated with, say, a product or a service. The way I think of it is continuous. You're trying to better understand how you fit within a marketplace, how your products and services deliver value. It's quite holistic. You know, you're not trying to focus on a cog. You're trying to focus on a system. So, you know, with iterative, it's like, you know, the idea of, well, we've got to make it better. And there's this concept that comes from, you know, mathematics, statistics, called the sort of local minimum. And I've got some paper with me because I thought it's good to draw stuff, because I'm one of these people that believes that if you can draw it, then you know it. So I constantly am getting my children, you know, whether it's a concept in chemistry or biology or history, I'm like, draw it for me. In fact, I shouldn't even just say my children. It's what I'll say in the Mensa. I will say, draw it, because then you know it.
Okay.
Rather than it being a bunch of, to your point, abstracted words. So you have this kind of local minimum and global minimum. And the actual global, the global maximum is a system, and the local minimum is a cog. And you can put slash cogs. So there are many, many, many different cogs. Now, let's take, you know, let's bring this back to digital products and services. You're trying to improve the conversion rate of people signing up for a process or buying a product. Many such things happen within digital. How do you actually know if you're actually making improvements? So they might say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to test one design over another design. Okay, so that's what I would call being trapped in the sort of local minimum. And it could be that you start to make improvements, but what happens is, instead of going up the curve, what happens is that you start to go down the curve. Can you imagine that? You're making investments, paying money, taking time and effort, working with your design team or your development team or external teams like Numensa, and things are going down.
So you're saying, right, you can have anything you like. What is it, cabbages or broccoli? But actually, people might want Brussels sprouts. But if that's not put in front of them, then that's exactly. Why you're going down.
Okay. So you keep selling broccoli and it keeps going off. And you're like, but we've made our broccoli stand better. In fact, we've got the best broccoli marketing in the world ever. I mean, we're the number one ranked place ever for broccoli. But they don't want broccoli. They want Brussels sprouts. Believe it or not. And I think that comes from that sense of taking a much more holistic systems perspective. When you're an experienced designer, that's kind of pretty critical. Okay. You're not just changing an element on a page. you have to think about the whole journey. I think I've said this to you before. I call it, is you don't want to get trapped in the kind of what I call the view from the top of the mountain. Now, can you imagine getting to the top of Mount Everest? How amazing that view would be. I mean, of course it's going to be amazing. You only have to put the view into Google. What's the view like from the top of Mount Everest? You could take that into any primary school, show them, and it would be jaw-dropping, wow, amazing, subliminal, awesome. Of course it would be. If you explained what is required to get to see that view, which means planning, going up the mountain, and then more importantly, coming down the mountain, all of a sudden, that kind of changes the perspective, that frames it in a much more holistic way. And this is the problem with digital design. Often digital design is really focused on getting people to the thing they want to get them to and trying to get them to do it. That means that they're really taking a very limited view of that journey. Any digital journey, regardless of what it is always bigger. There's a before, a during, and an after. It's much bigger than what we think. And the companies that kind of understand that and focus on that are thinking in terms of what is the value proposition that we're trying to deliver here. They're thinking in a much bigger picture way. So when you're thinking about experience design, you have to have this bigger picture way of thinking.
I mean, it's interesting with Everest, because Everest is, it's there. It's a permanent structure. It's not going to go anywhere in a hurry. But actually, business isn't like that. So people who do scale to the heights of Everest suddenly might find there's an earthquake and it's disappeared from under their feet. So let's take Kodak, for instance. So Kodak was the pinnacle of film, and now it's nowhere because digital has taken over and something has replaced it. So you've talked about experience strategies to me in the past, and that companies should have an experience strategy as much as a business strategy. What is that? And is that the sort of thing that you could employ to try and make sure that you maintain that view for a longer period of time?
Yeah, so if your goal is to deliver a great customer experience, then you're going to need a strategy. As it would be, if your goal is to achieve high levels of market visibility and market awareness, then you're going to have a marketing strategy and marketing plans and supporting activities and tactics that go with those plans and that strategy. And that marketing strategy will be part of a business strategy or corporate strategy. So businesses have lots of different strategies that are choreographed together. Often, they don't have a strategy for experience, yet they covet it. So to me, I will be told, we want to become number one at user experience. We want to provide the best customer experience in the market. So I will say, fantastic. Do you have an experience strategy?
Does anybody ever say yes?
They do.
Okay.
They do, yes. They do. But most of the time, there's silence. So then I follow up with...
Would you like one?
No.
Okay.
No, because it's a sense of we need to get beyond them talking about experience strategy like theatre. And I say that because if they talk about it like theatre, then they're assuming that sort of experience is something that can be kind of sprayed on from a can. We need to do the experience bit. We've made the product. Simon, do the experience bit. I'm kind of, hold on a second. It's kind of, I don't understand the value that you're trying to offer to the market. And they'll say, well, it's faster. Okay. It's got more functionality. Okay. And I'm like, so do people want faster and more functionality? Is that what they want? No, we've assumed it. We think that that's what they want. Sometimes they make reference to people like Steve Jobs. They'll say, Steve Jobs didn't do any research. He didn't have customer experience research and stuff like that. So I just remind them, I said, do you know what's really odd that you say that? So you know Steve Jobs' dad? He used to make furniture with his father. And his father taught him to do things like paint the backs of the cupboards, the bits that no one will see, which means that his father is teaching him about the design that is not so obvious, the design that is invisible but there. This is probably, you know, we were talking about it, like how we become to what we are. You can see this in the company that the man created and the products and experience that they imbue in what they are. There is a sense of design a sense of elegance that actually is just there at another level. So my response, when people used to say to me back in the day, well, they don't have user experience teams and stuff like that, I would just say their whole company is about customer experience. Their whole business is predicated on selling experience. And this is why, for example, they have one product, the iPhone, and they have completely disrupted the whole market, including, going back to your previous point, digital photography, which Kodak invented a long time before the iPhone came along. We're already masters at this concept, yet what they didn't realize was not just the fact that someone else could do it, but the fact that digital photography could become a mass market thing through the simple introduction of putting a camera inside a phone. And that's the point, because they saw it as a phone. How can our market be challenged by a phone? But is it a phone? Is it really a phone? This thing that can take pictures that almost look semi-professional, he coughs, or can kind of translate languages. Is that just a phone? It seems like that's much more than a phone. So I think the point being is that when you take this broader view and you think about actually what experience is, which is what Uber must have done, because if there wasn't the iPhone, it's arguable that there couldn't be an Uber. They took the fact that people had these devices, both riders, so people that want to travel in taxis, and drivers, and they brought them together through a platform. And because a phone already had GPS built in, it made it easy for them to overlay a lovely user interface that allowed people to connect with each other. So it's kind of, that's the thinking that's involved, rather than just thinking about technology as function, or technology is delivering benefit, or it's going to be faster, quicker, better. You have to think in a much more experiential way. As I often say, you can have the perfect team use the perfect process to create the perfect product that delivers perfectly no value.
Well, it's really interesting that as well, and that people do that. And I think that idea, you came back to Steve Jobs, is that it's okay to take other people's ideas. So Uber have taken the ideas of Steve Jobs, who took the idea of, well, Xerox, let's say, for the mouse. So that wasn't his invention. That was 20 years earlier from Xerox. And he just was the first person who thought, oh, we could use that. Why don't we use that? And the fact that Apple didn't do any research was a complete lie as well. They did loads of research.
Of course.
They just didn't tell anybody that they did research, because that would spoil the myth of the kind of Jobs, the whole Jobs image. I was talking to somebody the other day who was involved in creating a content-focused, it was kind of trying to link content management system together with a CRM system. So kind of very HubSpot-y kind of thing. But his argument was, well, HubSpot exists. Why don't we use that and we can build something on that, as opposed to having to build our own HubSpot? And I think eventually they did do something and it found a purpose. But in the meantime, he was able to develop and grow a really good, sustainable business based on technology that somebody else had created already. What you have to try and do is to then work out, but where's the real value for that? How can we try and get somebody else to improve that? So we don't have to put all of our money in that. We don't have to compete with that. We can compete in the space which is currently available to us. We just need to understand what the value is, and then we can use this technology which exists to be able to exploit it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, really good point. I mean, you don't have to start from scratch. You know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. I mean, there's lots of technologies that are out there, and I think you can look at existing platforms and existing technologies and think about, well, actually, how can we weave together our experience, our value with those technologies? I mean, that kind of thinking is definitely at the heart of, say, how the unicorn businesses operate. You know, they're looking to explore and exploit how we use digital technology and then start to provide ways of combining those technologies to add value. I mean, there's a kind of famous quote about the fact that if you look at what, say, Teams is, for example, which is Microsoft's defense of Slack, and you look at what Slack is, you start to look at the history of Slack and you start to dive into how Slack came into being and what their mission was, what they wanted to do, you know, what it started as and what it became are quite different things. And the founder is kind of well known for sort of saying, if we would have asked people what they wanted, they probably would have just said, well, we want better communications. But what does better communications mean? Mm. When you look at what Slack does, specifically around kind of threading and having conversations in a very organized way, well, it's not an enhancement to email systems. It's actually something more holistic. It's quite different. So it's no wonder that Microsoft invested in their Teams technology to make sure that actually they weren't disrupted in that way. So, you know, companies that are smart, like Microsoft, have actually thought, well, here's a technology that's coming along, could really disrupt our whole marketplace completely. So by making sure that their technology was as good as the Slack technology, well, this is, you know, this is a really good demonstration of how to defend disruption.
I mean, I suppose that comes back to your earlier point in terms of not necessarily iteration, but just kind of keeping a look at that holistic viewpoint, but continually doing that and not resting on your laurels too much, because there are always going to be these young upstarts who are going to come and threaten you. And some of them may start tiny, but, you know, they get the right investment. Sequoia gets involved and suddenly, you know, they're competing and bigger and better than you. I suppose the way you're talking about Slack sounds as if that was built with the community as well. What's the role of authenticity in all of this in terms of trying to develop something where you are working with your potential customers from the outset rather than it being a surprise, rather than having that ta-da moment? If you've just got, hey, we're thinking about doing this, what do you think about this? Is it a good idea, bad idea? What about if we had it this way? What do you think? And sort of building it in that respect. Do you see much of that happening?
So a more customer-centric approach, yes. That's definitely happening a lot more. I mean, it's the foundation of what we do here at Numensa. I mean, you want to be able to collaborate successfully, whether you're designing something new or you're modifying something that's existing. So, you really want to be in a position where you're trying to ensure that actual user feedback element in all the ways that you need to collect it is kind of going into the design process. And then whatever's coming out of the design process is also being tested and validated to make sure that it's kind of achieving the expectations that consumers want, as well as, say, commercial outcomes that the organization wants, so they can demonstrate a return on investment.
Well, I suppose quite often as well that people don't actually know what it is that they want. They'll tell you what they think they want, but until they see it or they have it, they don't know. And I suppose, do you embrace that whole area of behavioral science, behavioral economics, in terms of trying to understand that? Because quite often that's focusing on the difference between what people think they want and actually what they'll take up afterwards. I think we talked before about the Cialdini research, which was done with towels in a hotel room. So in the hotel room, in the bathroom, you'll get the message saying, think of the environment. And the question was, well, is that an effective message about not reusing towels? As opposed to saying, most people in this room reuse their towel. And just by saying that and not linking it to the environment, they actually had a 9% uptake in the reuse of towels. So people, when you ask them, will go, oh, no, I'm really concerned about the environment. Yeah, that's definitely a message I'll buy into. So how much is understanding of that and actually experimenting with stuff important to what you do?
I think it's pretty critical. I mean, one of my colleagues, George Moriarty, has written an article about this on our blog site recently. She makes the point around some of the government messages around COVID. And one of the messages is, act like you've got it. So this is very clever. So it kind of circumvents people's idea of, I haven't got it. I know I haven't got it, which we could say is like an example of optimum bias. So, you know, they're kind of exaggerating an event. You know, they're underestimating something. And the opposite of that being is they then overestimate something that is, you know, that they want to do. So, of course, they haven't got it. How could they have it? Whereas the message is not saying you do or you don't have it. It's saying act as though you have it. So it's making you think about how you should behave. It's not saying, it's not telling you that you have it. It's not telling you don't have it. So you could, you know, you could easily discount it. It's saying act as if you've got it, which is very, very clever. So you see lots of examples like this, and you can play that out with how people invest into their pensions. You know, you see this optimism bias coming again where I don't need to invest now because in the future, positively so they think, it will be okay. I will have the money to do it at a later date. Unbeknown to them is that this thing is cumulative and there's periods of time that you go through and it could be quite difficult to catch up. Now, if you were to go and say to them, you should do this, otherwise this will happen, what they can do is intend to do, what people tend to do is just discount that. So you have to find very clever ways of trying to get people to sort of step beyond what kind of Kahneman would call your kind of system one, your immediate, speedy response to something, to get them to consider it. And to do that, that means that you need to show them not what they won't get in a negative way, but what they might get. You need to show them where they are and then how they could get to somewhere else. So you need to be really, really savvy about these biases, because, and there are many of these cognitive biases, many, many, many. I prepared one for you earlier because I thought you might ask me such a question. So these tests, we call them cognitive reflection tests, okay? Have you come across the one about the bat and the ball? Do you know that one before I go on?
The bat and the ball?
Yeah.
No.
Bat and a ball cost £1.10 in total, okay? The bat costs £1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
Oh, actually, I did see this the other day, and I can't remember the answer. So the bat and the ball cost £1.10. The bat costs 10p more, do you say?
The bat costs £1 more than the ball.
And it costs £1.10 altogether.
How much does the ball cost?
God, no. Now you're going to ask me. It's not a pound is the answer, which is the obvious thing you want to go for.
So the question is, how much does the ball cost? So most people intuitively...
Oh, sorry, it's not 10p, it's what?
We'll go with 10p, as you said. However, that would make the bat £1.10 and the total £1.20, which is incorrect, yeah? Because it's £1 more.
Yeah.
So the correct answer is 5p.
Yeah.
Ball is 5p and the bat is £1.05. So added together, they make £1.10. Now, you could do that. If we did it as algebra and you sat down, you would work it out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I know this because my mother-in-law is a mathematician, so this is just simple algebra. And I said, yeah, but simple algebra is not something that people do. They make speedy decisions quite quickly.
Yeah.
But it shows us how we can make incorrect assessments. Those incorrect assessments then are kind of part of a decision-making process, which could be wrong. You know, you have to think about these things. You have to stop and consider, which is kind of like the slow system, yeah? So system two. So you really have to understand how these things can be kind of applied. The trick is that understanding the theoretical basis of something is one thing. Building it into a design and seeing it in action is a completely different thing. That requires a considerable amount of skill. I mean, can you imagine applying that kind of behavioral science thinking to, say, a transaction process, a form that had 75 screens with 200 interaction elements? I mean, that, you know, there's a level of complexity and sophistication in that design that transcends, say, one or two screens of form. I mean, you know, you could fit multiple tax return forms in such a thing. So you have to take this kind of broader view. You have to make sure that you work things out, that you just don't jump to conclusions. You don't rely on your gut feel all the time. That's not to say your gut feel is wrong, but it needs to be validated as well.
It's interesting in terms of how you can apply this to the impact of your business, of how you should think about your customers. But if you ask somebody whether Donald Trump or Boris Johnson is doing a good or a bad job, on the whole, if somebody has voted for them, they'll say he's doing a good job. And if somebody hasn't voted for them, they'll say they're doing a good job. And there's not a huge amount of deviation from the original assessment that somebody had before they put people into power. So people will have a different opinion about this one way or the other. But it's just very interesting. It doesn't really matter what happens. It's not changing anyone's opinion either way. So it's that sort of mindset that people will come with a set of ideas which they will arrive at your website to look at your product with, and they'll go, right, this is what I think. And it's very, very hard to try and shift that. I think there are some key moments in life where you can shift. And I think Richard Chotten kind of looks at that a little bit in terms of what is the right moment to try and get someone interested who otherwise have just got these habits and these ways of thinking. But new jobs, new house, new wife, new relationships, new kids, you know, these are all pivotal things where people take stock and suddenly think, as opposed to, you know, so for big decisions, as opposed to the whims that we live by. But just having some understanding of, well, what are the biases that people would bring with them to your product and your site in the first place could make a big difference about how you try and present that and engage people into what you're trying to offer.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. We really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.